This is Fresh Air. The controversy over the Clarence Thomas nomination turned many Americans into Supreme Court watchers. The court is more than midway through its current term, although some of the most controversial decisions are yet to come. Recent decisions offer insights into the judicial philosophy of Clarence Thomas and the new court. My guest Walter Dellinger is teaching a course on the current term of the Supreme Court. He's a professor of law at Duke University. On this day after Super Tuesday, Dellinger reminds us that the president we elect might shape the Supreme Court of the future.
Well, it's quite possible, Terry, that the next president of the United States in the next term, the next four-year term of a president, could name a majority of the Supreme Court, that is, five justices. Nothing is certain, but a number of people who watch the court carefully believe that the five possible retirements in the next 4 years would be Justices Blackmun and White, who are both in their 80s, Chief Justice Rehnquist, who is probably likely to retire in the next 4 years, and possibly Justices Stevens and Sandra O'Connor, each of whom had some difficulties with cancer that they have successfully surmounted, but nonetheless have given folks reason to wonder whether they may step down, so that we could possibly see a radically transformed court. As one of my friends jokes, we may see Chief Justice Hillary Clinton, depending on the outcome of the election. And if President Bush is reelected, I assume the court would continue to be filled with reasonably conservative justices. So we have these radically different futures for the Supreme Court, in some sense, depending on the outcome of the election.
Well, we've all been wondering what Clarence Thomas would be like on the Supreme Court, and we're getting some indication from his recent recent decisions. He's been writing a lot of opinions, often dissenting ones. Is he being very outspoken for a new justice?
Oh, very definitely. I mean, Justice David Souter, who joined the court a year ago, was very quiet for his first term, both from the bench and in opinions. He wrote almost no dissenting opinions of his own and very few opinions of the court. Justice Clarence Thomas, in contrast, has hit the ground running on the Supreme Court and has, I think, surprised many of those who follow the court at how outspoken and aggressive he's been. And it's been a very short time. He did not participate in the cases that were argued to the court in October before he joined it, so that he's had relatively few occasions so far. But he has used those occasions to set himself out in a fairly dramatic way. Even on the earliest indications, he appears to have established himself as the most conservative member of what is already a very conservative court.
What gives him that standing?
Well, I think he has joined with the person who used to be the court's most conservative member, Justice Scalia, in dissenting from opinions by other conservatives. I mean, dissenting from the right. For example, last week, the Supreme Court decided a case involving a cruel and unusual punishment of a prisoner, Hudson versus McMillan. In the Hudson case, the inmate had an argument with one of the custodial guards, and two officers handcuffed and shackled the inmate. And according to the evidence the inmate presented, he was punched in the mouth, eyes, chest, and stomach while handcuffed and shackled, and kicked and punched from behind, while the supervisor told the two guards, quote, not to have too much fun, unquote. He suffered bruises, swelling, cracked dental plate. He sued and got $800 from a federal magistrate on the grounds that this was cruel and unusual punishment, and the Supreme Court agreed. That is, all of the Supreme Court but Justices Thomas and Scalia Justice O'Connor wrote the opinion for the court and said that the excessive and unreasonable, unnecessary and wanton infliction of pain gives rise to the possibility of a suit for damages. This was a relatively small $800 case, and Justice Thomas could have quietly joined in it. It didn't establish any great new law, but he wrote a very strong dissenting opinion, arguing that there should be no right of a prisoner to sue for a physical beating unless there was, quote, significant injury, unquote, the kind of injury that would require treatment in the prison hospital. Justice Thomas was joined in that dissent only by Justice Scalia, but it was a very outspoken step for a new and most junior member of the court.
I think everybody's been wondering how Thomas's background as an African American would affect his opinions on the Supreme Court. And one example we can look to for some clues about that is a case about a man who was sentenced to death in 1986 and appealed, saying that his rights were violated when his membership in a white supremacist prison group was used to persuade the jurors to sentence him to death. And Thomas was the lone dissenter in this case. He said that that should have been relevant, that it should have been allowed to be introduced, that he belonged to this white supremacist group. Can you explain the significance of this case and what you think that tells us, if anything, about Thomas as an African American?
Well, I think that the decision in that case, which is Dawson against Delaware, decided just this week, tells us more about Justice Thomas's attitudes towards capital punishment and his willingness to defer to prosecutorial interest than it does about any racial views. In this case, the prosecution introduces as one of the aggravating factors that the jury should take into account Dawson's membership in the Aryan Brotherhood, a white supremacist organization in the prison. And with that evidence before it, the jury came in with a sentence of execution. Dawson appealed, and the Supreme Court agreed that it was error to introduce the evidence of his membership. All other eight members of the court believed that it had First Amendment implications when the state would use someone's mere membership in an organization that had white supremacist views in this case. It was error to and stress the First Amendment, at least to introduce that as a factor in whether the individual should be executed. Justice Thomas was the lone dissenter. Again, it is surprising when a brand new junior justice will be the lone dissenter. He thought that the jury ought to know that the defendant had been and was a member of a racist organization. I think one should not draw any racial conclusions from that. It is as likely in future cases that death row inmates will be members of black militant organizations in prison as it is that they will be members of white supremacist organizations. I mean, this is going to be a two-way street. Justice Thomas's opinion would let in both kinds of evidence. The other eight justices consider this irrelevant.
We're talking about the current term of the Supreme Court. My guest is Duke University law professor Walter Dellinger. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Duke University law professor Walter Dellinger is my guest. Were you very surprised by any of the recent decisions that were handed down?
Not dramatically surprised. I think it was the one case that was a little bit surprising was to see that this court is now sufficiently conservative that it's more conservative than the Department of Justice in a Republican administration in some areas. I think this term represented the very first time in which the Justice Department's position in a voting rights case was rejected by the Supreme Court. The Bush administration argued that the Voting Rights Act was violated when a town, once its county commission had been had gained both white and black members, when they took power away from the newly elected black commissioners. The Justice Department said this should be considered as falling within the Voting Rights Act and remediable under that act. And a majority of the Supreme Court said no, the Voting Rights Act only applies when you cast your vote and doesn't apply thereafter. So I think it is pretty eye-opening how, in that sense, how conservative the court has become.
A lot of people have been concerned about how activist a Supreme Court we will have and how activist they will be in overturning liberal decisions of the past. That leads me to wonder how the Supreme Court decides which decisions it's going to hear.
In many ways,
cases it's going
yes,
to hear.
Yes, no, right. In many cases, many instances, the most important thing the Supreme Court decides is what to decide. Every year, about 3,500 cases are brought to the court's attention by applications to have the court hear and review a case. And of those more than 3,000 cases, the Supreme Court will usually select about 150 cases to hear. So that's a very important part of the process. Deciding which cases to hear. Sometimes, it's easy to eliminate a lot of the cases that are genuinely insignificant, but it's a very difficult choice for the court, and the court can, in a sense, set its agenda. To give you an example, Terry, this year, the court has granted several cases that involve property rights. Has accepted cases that property owners have brought complaining about environmental regulations and complaining that certain environmental regulations violate the property owner's constitutional rights. So this is now a court that is sufficiently conservative that it is at least interested in looking at property rights under the Constitution. And that reflects a new direction in the court and one that the court can make because of its power to decide what cases it's going to hear.
Who decides who writes the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion?
Well, once a case has been, it's interesting, the court reaches a tentative conclusion in a case very quickly. After the briefs have been submitted and oral argument, half hour aside, has been heard by the court. They'll hear oral arguments giving each side their 30 minutes on a Monday through Thursday. And then on Friday, the court will meet in its own very, very private, very confidential conference. I mean, it's so private that the junior justice acts as the person that goes to the door and takes and receives messages. At its private conference, the court will tentatively vote on each of the cases in which it heard argument that week. Then the chief justice will assign the opinion of the court in each of the cases. Assuming the Chief Justice is with the majority. If he's not, the most senior justice in the majority assigns the opinion. Then the opinion writer will have anywhere from 3 weeks to sometimes 2 or 3 months to draft an opinion of the court and circulate it around to the rest of the members. This is all still private and behind the scenes. This process is going on now in some of these major cases. Once the majority opinion is circulated, the justices who dissent from it sort of informally caucus among themselves as to who will draft a dissenting opinion. Again, at this stage, there's no final judgment, and sometimes, the draft dissenting opinion does such a good job of showing the weaknesses in the majority opinion that a majority of the court shifts. Likes the dissenting opinion better, finds it more persuasive, and changes the result in the case. That happens, I would estimate, since we don't know publicly, 2 or 3 times a term that the dissenting opinion wins the battle for the hearts and minds of the nine members of the court.
Walter Dellinger is a law professor at Duke University.